Okay, shall we begin? Shall we begin? Cool. Shall we begin? So today we're talking significantly about what we call planning. Planning as distinct from architecture, but still planning as a part of architecture. So many schools of architecture are called schools of architecture and planning. Definitely in the School of Architecture here, we have a planning program. Sometimes it's called community and regional planning. Sometimes it's called urban planning. There are a lot of different taglines for it, but you can't have a class in architecture without talking to some extent about how does it work with planning. And planning, in some senses, it's just architecture on a larger scale. And now we're not just talking about the scale of the neighborhood or the scale of the city, but maybe even the scale of the region. So we're thinking about how architecture impacts larger regional things, and that might be regional transportation. I mean, you can't just think about how do you get around in Austin and how does that interface with neighborhoods and communities and things like that. But you have to think about it, well, then how does it work with a more regional transportation system? And so there are many aspects of architecture that reach out, and we have to think of them on a larger scale. In general, I guess we think about planning as not as precise as architecture. So generally when you're doing a planning project, you're thinking of creating kind of systems or frameworks or general ideas. So, for instance, when there's a master plan for the campus, we talked about that when we took the tours, it's a general idea of where the campus is going. Is every building going to be exactly in that spot? Is it, you know, is every dimension going to be exactly right eventually? No, it's a general plan. It's a framework. It's an infrastructure. It's a code that then the design can work around. So there have been probably several hundred plans for Austin, starting with the Waller plan in 1839 that we looked at a while back. And that laid out the grid of streets, 14 blocks by 14 blocks. But you know, some of those streets actually never got paved or implemented, and some of those bridges across the creeks never got built, so the street was interrupted. So the general plan was there, but the exact implementation of that might not have been precisely what was envisioned. In a place like Paris, there would have been thousands of plans for Paris over the years, and each of them might have had an impact on the city. But the city is not a fully implemented version of any plan that was done of those thousands of plans that have been done over hundreds of years. So we think of planning, when we're designing a plan, it's a little different than we think of designing a building. So that's one fundamental difference. Another thing is, I guess we generally think of urban planning these days as not being so much about form. So everything we discussed in the first one-third of the class, maybe planners are getting more interested in form than they used to be, but they're probably more interested in physical considerations and human factors than they are in form. So that's another kind of difference. And I would say that in the field of planning, there are five distinct areas we might think of. And they all interface with architecture in one way or another, but some interface way more than others. So one area of planning is economic planning. And this is things like, for the city of Austin, they're constantly thinking, what are businesses we need to attract here? What are industries we'd like to come here? What is our tax structure? How do we deal with disadvantaged people? How do we get affordable housing? You know, all of those kinds of things are economic planning, and very, very essential for the success of the city. So architecture certainly interfaces with that in terms of providing facilities for companies that might come here, or how do we build affordable housing, and how do we make a relationship between affordable housing and other housing, and how does that build neighborhoods? And so economic planning has to do with architecture for sure. Another area of planning is land use planning. And land use planning is where you say, okay, we're going to have residential areas here, we're going to have industrial areas here, we're going to have commercial areas here, we're going to have mixed use areas there, we're going to have high density here, we're going to have low density there. All of that land use planning, very, very important part of any city's development. And it has a lot to do with architecture, because what functions you put where and what densities, whether it's high-rise buildings or whether it's single-family houses, these are certainly controlled by, significantly, land use planning. And land use planning helps us avoid the kind of conflicts like maybe you really don't want an elementary school next to a porno shop. Yeah, not good. So we have land use plans that say that if you want to open a porno shop, there's only certain places you can put your porno shop. And it's not next to the elementary school. You got that, dude? Okay. In the same way, maybe you don't want a noisy industrial function going in next to a family residential neighborhood. Maybe the noise is too obnoxious. But if you put a warehousing district next to that industrial area, that's probably just fine. So land use planning has to do with both getting functions in the right place and also getting densities in the right place. Then a third kind of planning is infrastructure planning. And this is super essential and very much interfaces with architecture. You've got to have water treatment plants, sewer treatment plants, electrical generation plants. You've got to have umbilicals of power and water and wastewater that service all of the buildings in an area. And you can't build those buildings if you don't have the proper infrastructure to serve them. And so how that infrastructure is planned, where it's distributed, what quantities it's distributed in, what capacities those lines have, and what loads they can take, these are all really essential in the conformation of the city. So we have economic planning, we have land use planning, we have infrastructure planning. A fourth area is transportation planning. And, of course, this is huge. How do you get people around? And that's even at the level of pedestrian. Do we have good sidewalks? Do we have adequate places for people to walk from one place to another? Currently a pretty big issue in West Campus. We have huge numbers of people, way more than used to live there, now live there. They're trying to get to the campus. And maybe some of you had this experience at certain hours in the morning or in the afternoon. There's a traffic jam of people. And that's kind of transportation planning. Have we made the sidewalks adequate for people to be able to go from point A to point B like they need to? And the same way with bicycles. You know, have we got bike lanes? Have we got safe places where the bicycles can go? This is a part of transportation planning. Do we have buses? We're about to vote on a big light rail bond issue. November 5th. That's hugely important to this community. If we get a light rail, wow, it's going to be, I think, fantastic. Make a huge positive difference for this city. If we vote down that light rail, then we're stuck with car culture. And everybody's got to get around in single-family cars, and we'll pollute the air a whole lot more, and we'll have traffic jams a whole lot more. And so what do we want to do about that issue? That's transportation planning. I was just on a forum last night talking about that with a bunch of transportation geeks, transportation planners who were talking about, you know, this is the impact it will have on the city. This is how Dallas put in their light rail. This is how Houston put in their light rail. This is the light rail system in Hong Kong or in Singapore or in, you know, other cities around the world. And this is the impact it has. And I was on that panel because I was talking about this is the impact it has on building communities. You know, when you have a rail stop, then you start having a place where people wait. And when they wait, they talk to each other face to face like this. Dude, why are you getting all the attention today? I don't know. But anyway, so we're talking face to face, and pretty soon you build a kind of sense of community, and then it isn't long before a Starbucks comes there because there are people waiting for the bus and disgorging, or the light rail, and disgorging from the light rail. And then when the Starbucks is there, then McDonald's and Burger King, a few other places show up, and pretty soon you have a little neighborhood service center, and then a dry cleaner moves in, and then the grocery store comes, and then you have a real kind of node for your neighborhood. And that comes because there was a rail line stop there. And if you don't have rail, you don't have mass transit like that, all you have is seas of anonymous suburbia. And you don't have those kinds of sense of community that comes of having special places like a rail stop. So transportation planning has a whole lot to do with the kind of communities and the kind of neighborhoods and kind of buildings we do. It's a fourth kind of planning. The fifth kind of planning is environmental planning. And this has to do with how do we deal with rain and wind and stormwater and flooding and erosion and endangered species habitats, and how do we keep clean water in our creeks and in our lakes and in our rivers? How do we keep clean air? All of those are environmental planning. And those, again, have an enormous amount to do. Buildings themselves have a big impact. How we build those buildings have a big impact on the environmental quality. And so planning and architecture have to work together to appropriate environmental planning. So you need to have this down in your notes. It could crop up on a test, maybe, that these four areas of planning. There's economic planning, there's land use planning, there's infrastructure planning, transportation planning, and environmental planning. So that's just to give a kind of big picture, and we're going to hone down today, because we're talking about physical considerations. We're going to be talking about environmental planning primarily today, and we'll look at the issues that come up, and the important environmental issues that are dealt with where architecture and planning are working together. So that means we're talking in general about geography, topography, and ecology, and that means how we're dealing with soils and rain and land slope and all kinds of issues that deal with that. So at the beginning here, let me read you a little story. And this little story will kind of maybe point out the importance of environmental planning. So this is actually the introduction to a classic book called Site Planning, which really means planning, you know, the land or the environment, by a guy named Simons. And so let me just read this to you. So once there was a hunter who spent his days tracking the wide prairies of North Dakota with a gun and a dog and sometimes with a small boy who would beg to trot along. On this particular morning, hunter and boy, far out on the prairie, sat watching intently a rise of ground ahead of them. It was pocked with gopher holes. From time to time, a small striped gopher would nervously whisk from the mouth of the den to the cover of matted prairie grass, soon to reappear with cheek food pouches bulging. Smart little outfits, those gophers, the hunter observed. I mean, the way they have things figured out. Whenever you come upon a gopher village, you can be sure it will be near a patch of grain where they can get their food, and close by a creek or slough for water. They'll not build their town near the willow clumps, for that's where the owls and the hawks will be roosting. And you'll not be finding them near the stony ledges or a pile of rocks where their enemies, the snakes, will be hiding, ready to snatch them. When these wise little critters build their towns, they search out the southeast slope of a knoll that will catch the full sweep of the sun each day to keep their dens warm and cozy. The winter blizzards that pound out of the north and west to leave the windward slopes of the rises frozen solid will only drift loose powder snow on top of their homes. When they dig their dens, continued the hunter, do you know what they do? They slant the runway steeply down for 2 or 3 feet and then double back up near the surface again where they level out a nice dry shelf. That's where they lie, close under the sod roots, out of the wind, warmed by the sun, near to their food and water, as far away as they can get from their enemies, and surrounded by all their little gopher friends. Yes, sir, they sure have things planned out. Is our town built on the southeast slope? The small boy asked thoughtfully. No, the hunter said. Our town slopes down to the north in the teeth of the bitter winter winds and cold as a frosty gun barrel. He frowned. Even in summer, the breezes work against us. When we built the new flax mill, the only mill for 40 miles around, where do you think we put it? We built it right smack in the only spot where every breeze in the summertime can catch the smoke from its stack and pour it across our houses and into our open windows. At least our town is near the river and water, said the boy defensively. Yes, replied the hunter, but where near the river did we build our homes? On the low, flat land inside the river bend, that's where. And each spring, when the snows melt on the prairie and the river swells, it floods out every cellar in town. Gophers would plan things better than that, the small boy decided. Yes, said the hunter, a gopher would be smarter. When gophers plan their homes in towns, the boy philosophized, they seem to do it better than people do. Yes, mused the hunter, and so do most of the animals I know. Sometimes I wonder why. So I love that story for the fact that it contrasts gophers, who actually think of environmental planning as the sine qua non. It is the thing you have to do. You have to do environmental planning because you have to live with nature. And the difference between them and sometimes mankind that basically says, oh, what the hell, we can beat up nature if we need to. We don't have to worry about their rules. We're big, strong, powerful human beings. We can do what we want to do. And then if it causes a problem, well, we'll just fix it, beat it up, make it work. And maybe sometimes we should be more like the gophers and not cause those problems for ourselves, but instead see if we could work more with natural forces and be in more in concert with that. So today, we're going to be looking at geography, topography, and ecology. We're going to be looking at soils and wind and rain and sun and erosion and endangered species and flooding and all of the kinds of things that happen if you don't pay attention to geography, topography, and ecology. Now, in Austin, this is a huge issue. And sometimes Austin is thought of as a bunch of tree huggers, environmentally, maybe even over-aware people. The truth is we have to be in Austin. We don't really have a choice because this is a very ecologically sensitive area that we happen to have inhabited here. And it's very fragile in terms of if we do the wrong thing, then it really can screw things up and put us in a really bad position. So sometimes people in Austin talk about the three E's here. Austin is not a port city. We're not here because there was a fabulous place for a port. There's not an economic basis in some geographical thing like a port here. Likewise, we never were a hub for transportation. I mean, Houston was a great port city. Dallas was a hub for transportation. All the railways came through there, and so it became a big city because it was a hub for rail transportation first and then air transportation second. But we don't have anything like that in Austin. I told you, when they founded the city in 1839, they just thought that was a cool-ass hill there, and they liked the way it sloped down to the river, and that's why we're here. And so there really isn't a lot of economic reason for having a major metropolis in this place. All we have to sell in Austin in terms of our economic future is exactly what brought those people here, which was the beauty of this place. So we talk about these three E's. The three E's are environment and experience and economy. And those three E's are linked. So if we have an environment that is beautiful and healthy, that is, we have clean water in our creeks and our rivers, and we have clean air, and we have beautiful natural hills and parks and features, that is something that was intrinsically in this place. It's a hell of a lot more beautiful naturally than some other places in Texas, like Houston or Dallas. So there was something here to begin with that was pretty cool. If we keep it, then it's an asset. If we destroy it, then we killed the goose that laid the golden egg. So environment is important here. And then a healthy environment leads to a positive experience. And it tends to attract people who maybe want to do more outdoors activities. They want to swim in Barton Springs Pool, which is like about the best swimming place in the world and just an amazing, amazing experience. And there are a lot of people that they're attracted to a place like Austin because there's the possibility of doing something in nature like that. Or people who like to bicycle and they love the Lance Armstrong Bikeway and all these places where they can even mountain bike and do all these things out in nature. Or they like to hike around, or they like to fish, or like to hunt, or that there are all kinds of things in the hill country that those outdoor recreation things they're appealing. So from a healthy environment comes a kind of experience and lifestyle that people find appealing, that puts them in connection with recreation and nature in a positive way. And then out of that comes an economic benefit, because these days there are plenty of jobs and plenty of companies that it doesn't really matter where they are. They don't have to be near the port. They don't have to be near the transportation hub. They can work remotely from anywhere. So they're going to go someplace where it's enjoyable to live, where there's a good experience, there's a good lifestyle. And that is the big economic boon for Austin. That's what attracts companies here, and that's what attracts individuals here. And it makes us have a workforce that is very appealing to a company. Apple moved in here several years ago, primarily because there's the workforce they want to attract. People who they like to work for them like to live here. And these days, people often decide, first, I'm going to find a place that I want to live, and then I'll find a job. And so if we're appealing as a place to live, our economy grows because companies come here because we got cool-ass people who want to live here, and they're smart. So in Austin, we don't have a choice. We have a delicate ecosystem that we can screw up pretty easily, and our economy is dependent on environment and experience. And if we screw that up, then our economic basis is diminished. So we have to be aware of geography, topography, ecology, environmental planning, all those kinds of issues. So let me give you an example of how this would work, how these issues determine architectural or urban form. So a number of years ago, in my firm, we were involved with building the new airport. And now it's not the new airport, it's 16 years old, and we're doing a big addition to it. But when it first was built, there was a study done of where should we have a new airport. Our existing airport was really super convenient. It was over at Mueller. It was Robert Mueller Airport, right on Airport Boulevard over there. Very close in, but as the city got bigger and they got bigger airplanes and the bigger airplanes made more noise, and then there got to be lawsuits by residents and churches and schools for the noise violation of all these planes that were coming right into the middle of the city. So the people who brought the lawsuit won the lawsuit, and the court basically said to the city of Austin, you either need to noise-proof all of those houses and all of those churches and all of those schools within a certain radius, or you need to move the airport. The court told them that. So it was much cheaper to build a new airport than to soundproof all of those buildings, and you would have had to do that in perpetuity, and it would have been very, very difficult and expensive and bureaucratic. So we're in a difficult situation. We've got to move our airport. This is in the 1990s. So how do you find a big piece of land that is appropriate for an airport? And one of the first analyses was, well, we need to think of it environmentally. So Austin, part of the reason why we have this cranky ecosystem is because we're at a very interesting place geologically. The Balcones Fault goes right through Austin. And that is a fault line between two completely different kinds of geography. On the east side of the Balcones Fault is the coastal prairie, and it goes down to the Gulf of Mexico. And in that coastal prairie, it basically is alluvial soil, and it's the kind of geography that happens around an ocean. On the other side of that fault line is basically the hill country. And it's a completely different kind of geology, and that fault happened at one point where there was an uplift of all that hill country land, and it came up adjacent to that coastal plain and made this complete disruption in the ecology. Now, that attracted a certain kind of species of plants and of animals that are very unique because they bridge between those two geographical areas, and that's part of what makes this a kind of delicate and unusual and unique ecology. But if you're planning an airport, that's very important to understand, because one of the things you're very concerned about with airports is soil conditions. You want to make a foundation, not just for the building, but it's really for the runways. You can imagine this enormous airplane that is coming out of the sky. It's falling, and it's about to crash into the ground and land. And imagine the impact of that incredibly heavy object smashing onto the ground. Now, you can put a badass concrete runway there to absorb that load, but all that's going to do is transfer that load to whatever the soil is below it. And that soil has to take that load. So some kinds of soil can take that load, and some kinds of soil are completely incapable of taking that load. Where that Balcones Fault hits, to the west of that, right below the ground, is limestone. Really strong, really sturdy, fantastic for taking that load. To the east of that fault line is alluvial soil, primarily clay, and this is mucky, awful, nasty foundation stuff. It's terrible, terrible for foundations. It's what's called Del Rio clay, and depending on its moisture content, it swells and it shrinks. So if we put this concrete runway on that Del Rio clay, it swells and it shrinks. It's completely undependable. It also is not very strong. It doesn't take so many pounds per square inch. So you can look all over the region around Austin, and if you're looking to put an airport, you want to find those areas that have limestone below the ground, okay? We're looking for limestone. It'll make it much, much more affordable to build an airport if we have good soil conditions. So that's one geographical factor. Another thing is, if you're building an airport, you want it to be flat. We like to land airplanes on flat runways. Now, they don't have to be 100% flat, but they have to be pretty darn flat. And that Balcones Fault also makes a differentiation between the coastal plains that are, in fact, very, very flat to the east, and the hill country, which is anything but flat, to the west. So if you get all these maps out and you look at where are the flat areas in Austin, they're all on the east side of the Balcones Fault. But if you take the same maps out and you look at where are all the areas with limestone below the ground, they're all on the west side of the Balcones Fault. So where the hell do you put the airport? You know, it's telling us contradictory things. So then you start looking at those places where there's a little overlap, where maybe the limestone soil goes under a fairly flat area. And so that was where the study area was all of those areas along that intersection. Now, you definitely don't want to be on the Balcones Fault, because that's an unstable area. So you can figure out, and you can do this analysis, and there were only like six or eight places anywhere that were reasonable to put the airport. One of them was Manor, which was pretty far out. One of them was Bergstrom, which was pretty close in. And Bergstrom was the one that was settled on. So that is using geography, topography, ecology, using environmental things to help tell you about where to put an airport. Now, there were other things, too. You certainly had to worry about wind because airplanes depend on air movement and wind, so you didn't want to find a place that's particularly turbulent. That's another issue of geography, topography, ecology. You'd want to worry about obstructions, so you don't want to have a hill or something like that that is obstructing the flight going in or coming out. So that's another issue of geography, topography, ecology. And you also would worry about other things, like you don't want to put it in a highly developed area, then you have the same noise problems you had with the old airport. You don't want to put it particularly on agricultural land that might be valuable and productive in other ways, and now you'd be taking it out of that productivity. You don't want to put it in areas that are habitat for endangered species, because that would screw up another kind of ecology. So when you layer all those things on top of each other, you can make intelligent decisions, environmental planning decisions, about where you do a major facility, a major urban and architectural intervention like an airport. Okay, so that's how we use geography, topography, ecology to do environmental planning. So today we're going to have three major examples we're going to look at. And the first example is a bad example. It's not working. It's a screw-up. But to let us see what it's like if you don't do good environmental planning. And then the second two examples will be much better examples. So the first example is actually of my hometown. I'm going to sit here and tell you a sad tale about my hometown. And it's one that I actually, in my lifetime, I can see the problem that was created there. So I grew up in Friendswood, Texas. Anybody here from Friendswood? Yes, two people from Friendswood. But it really is the whole region around there has the same characteristics. So Friendswood, Pearland, League City, Alvin, Clear Lake City, Kima, all of that area would have very much the same issues. So how many of you are from any of that general area? Okay, a few more. So you guys got to tell me if I'm lying here, because you haven't seen it as long as I've seen it, but you've seen it for a fairly long period of time. So when I was a little kid, the population of Friendswood was 900. Now it's 35,000. When I was a kid, it was a totally hick town. There were 40 people in my graduating class. Pretty much everybody in my graduating class, you had two choices. Either you went to Vietnam or you got pregnant. That's kind of what everybody did. So it was pretty much a hick town. And it was really small. And the major industry in the town was figs. There were fig orchards, and there was the fig plant that made them into preserves. Not a big operation. It was kind of definitely a hick operation. But in the general area, the biggest use of that land was either for rice farming or for grazing cattle. And this was far enough outside of Houston that it was a standalone town, and everything around it was just open land, which was either in rice fields or in cow pastures. And often they would flip back and forth. So you would have something that would be a rice field for 2 years, and then they'd cycle it back and let the cows graze on it. And when the cows graze on it, they also poop on it. And when they poop on it, that's fertilizer. And so it makes it more fertile for the rice. Then the rice comes in and depletes the nutrients in the soil, and then the cows come back and replenish the nutrients in the soil. It was a pretty good system. And it worked that way for generations. So there were three geographical characteristics of that area that were really important. It is flat as a pancake, just almost no topography. It's in that coastal plain and extremely, extremely flat. And that meant that when, well, it's not a place that's easy to drain because it was completely flat. Then a second characteristic was that it had clay soils. So right under the ground, it's very similar to the Del Rio clay we have here, but it actually, we called it black gumbo, was the clay. And it's a really sticky clay. It's not absorptive at all. So you can like pour water on the ground and it just kind of sits there because it's the sticky clay that doesn't absorb so well. And then the third characteristic was it was subject to very heavy rains in that area. Sometimes you just get a downpour and like the clouds opened up and tons of water came out. And especially in hurricane season, you could get a hurricane come through and there would be, you know, 30 inches of rain in 3 days, which is ridiculous, just tons and tons of rain. So in general, it gets fairly good rainfall, about 52 inches a year. But it often came in these deluges all at the same time. So a combination of those three characteristics, flat as a pancake, clay soils, and heavy rains, meant that there always was a drainage problem there. It was hard for water to evacuate when you had a heavy rain. But the way that they dealt with it was they had a drainage system. And when I grew up, there were basically, everybody had a ditch in their front yard. And man, hardly anybody has ditches anymore. There are probably a few of you that live in rural areas that have a ditch in your front yard. And then when the driveway goes over it, there's a culvert, you know, a big round concrete culvert. And ditches were very important recreational areas in my little town because when it rained, they'd fill up with water. And you'd roll up your blue jeans and you'd go out there and, hey, we have got a swimming pool. And so that was the closest we ever came to a swimming pool. And, you know, the crawdads would all build their little things there and you'd stick holes down and try to get the crawdads to come out. This was recreation in my childhood, I'm sorry to say. No Game Boys, just crawdads and ditches full of water. So that was a very important part of the drainage system. So everybody's house and lot and fields would drain to the ditch. The ditch would then drain into a ravine, which would be a bigger ditch, and the ravine would drain into the bayou, Chocolate Bayou, or there were other bayous around there. And then the bayou would drain into a creek, like Clear Creek or Mary's Creek, where the creeks in our town. And then the creeks would go into Clear Lake, and then Clear Lake went into the Gulf of Mexico. So the drainage system, it was very, very tortured path, and it wasn't direct at all. And if you fly over that area now and you look at the path of a creek, it's not like a creek goes like this. The creek goes like this because it can't find any lower ground to go to. And so you had all this circuitous movement of water trying to get to the Gulf of Mexico, but generally through ditches and ravines and bayous and creeks and Clear Lake and into the Gulf of Mexico. So that had been going on for eons. That all worked pretty well. And one of the things, I mean, our house was not anywhere near the creek. Our land went up to the creek. We had a big piece of land, and the creek ran through our land. But when we built our house, no way you built on the creek. We built on the higher ground a long way away from the creek. And that's what pretty much everybody did. Okay. So then in 1962, NASA moved into this area, Manned Spacecraft Center. A huge transformation occurred. So LBJ had always gotten lots of campaign funds from what was then, what now is Exxon, but before then was Humble Oil and Refinery. And Humble Oil owned a whole lot of land in that area. And so LBJ made a deal with them, and who knows what happened financially. But anyway, the Manned Spacecraft Center ended up in the middle of nowhere, basically, but in this general area. And they started building important research facilities and office buildings and And then all these people moved in. Tons of Yankees moved in, complete aliens. We didn't even understand the way they talked. And all their parents were engineers. We didn't even know any. We thought that was like, runs a choo-choo train. It's like an engineer. Oh, what's an engineer? We were hicks. And they were all well-educated. They were a lot smarter than we were. But they all moved in droves and droves of all these engineers and Yankees, people from Pennsylvania, New York, and Ohio, and Chicago, and they all moved in. And when they came in, their parents thought, whoa, this is really pretty. We love these creeks. Look at those big trees. Myrtle, look, it's Spanish moss. Oh, I love Spanish moss. Let's live by the creek where there's Spanish moss and there's big trees. And so they loved the creek areas, and they were pretty, and the creek was meandering, you know, went back and forth. It looked pretty. So sure enough, the subdivisions started being by the creeks where it was pretty and where there were big trees. And so in my little town, the first really big, cool, rich person subdivision was named Imperial Estates. Wow. In our little town, we had Imperial Estates. I don't know who the emperor was, but we had Imperial Estates. And it was rich people's houses. And it was on either side of Clear Creek, and they built really nice big houses. And one of the seven original Mercury astronauts lived in Imperial Estates. And Chris Kraft, who was the spokesperson for NASA, who every time they had a space shot, it was his voice that was the voice of NASA. Chris Kraft and his family lived in Imperial Estates. His kid went to school with me. Shitty, crappy kid. Anyway, everybody, all these big NASA officials lived in Imperial Estates. And it was, for the rest of us, that was hoity-toity part of town. So they start building up lots of subdivisions. The town's growing like crazy. The school's growing like crazy. And it's a big transformation. Okay, three problems came up in this boom that happened in this area. The first problem was a problem of impervious cover. I-M-P-E-R-V-I-O-U-S, impervious cover. And that meant that when they started to develop the area, they had to put in new roads, and they made good concrete roads, and they had to put in parking lots for the new grocery stores and fast food places that cropped up, and they had to put in the foundations. They used slab-on-grade foundations for the new homes in Imperial Estates and in all the new shopping areas and all of that. And so you start covering lots and lots and lots of the ground that had been just soil. Now it's got concrete on it. And concrete is impervious cover. Water can't go through it. So although there was a problem with drainage already, now a large part of the soil wasn't even there to take any water. It was impervious to water. And in some areas, up to 60% of the land was impervious cover. So that means the remaining 40% has to take all of the absorption that would previously have been taken by 100% of the land. Now it's got to all go in 40% of the land. So you just can't have as much absorption of rainfall when it comes down. So one problem was we had lots and lots of impervious cover. A second problem was storm sewers. And the storm sewers, like I said, we had these ditches, and even the word ditch, I mean, that sounds low class, right? So our house had a ditch in front, and it was low class. In Imperial Estates, they were not going to have ditches, okay? No ditches, ditch. Ooh, sounds awful. So instead, they had storm sewers. And that means that you have a nice concrete street, and you have a curb on the side of the street, and then, you know, these things, we don't even notice them so much, but the curb directs the water down to a gutter, and that gutter takes the water to a storm sewer system. We just don't pay attention to this stuff, but it's there all over, and all that water drains down into the storm sewer system, And then it goes into pipes. And it's a, first it's a small pipe, and then several pipes collect, and it's a bigger pipe, and then several bigger pipes collect, and it's a huge pipe, and eventually it goes out to a creek or a river or something like that. So that's storm sewer systems. But storm sewer systems are a little different than the ditches. The ditches were grossly oversized, and it wasn't expensive to do that. You just, when you have the ditch digger go along there, you just move a little more dirt and you get a bigger ditch. And if it isn't big enough and starts overflowing in the yard, you just have the guy come out and dig the ditch a little deeper. And it's no big deal. It's cheap. But storm sewers are expensive, so they have engineers who come in and say, yes, you need a 30-inch diameter storm sewer. And that's exactly how much water you'll be conveying. And so it's pretty precise. Then if the demand gets to be higher and 30 inches isn't big enough, then you're screwed. I mean, you have to take everything out and start all over again. And that's super expensive. So they had these finite storm sewer systems that they put in, and they could only carry so much water. And that had been really different from the previous system that had a lot of overflow possibility. So one problem is impervious cover. The second problem is storm sewer systems. And the third problem is subsidence, S-U-B-S-I-D-E-N-C-E, subsidence. And this means that the ground is falling. You know, Chicken Little always worried about the sky is falling. This is the ground is falling. And what happens, and this is, again, we don't think of this so much. You don't think of the ground being held up by water, but it is, in fact. Down below the ground, there's a water table. And the ground is sitting on this water, and the water is buoyant enough that it keeps the ground up. So in this area, there was a very high water table, and it actually was very clean water. So everybody, we did too. In my front yard, we had a well that had been drilled down. You only had to drill down about 60 feet, and you hit the water table, and you could get good, clean water. And when we first moved into our house, that's the water we had. We didn't have city water. We were hicks. We had just the water we pumped out of the ground. And then even when we got city water, we had that well, and we used it to water the lawn, things like that, and free. So everybody had always had these water wells. But then when lots more people moved in, then the city started putting a well down and getting that water, and the city water came from the water table right below. And as they pumped more and more and more water, because we had more and more and more people, then they started pumping out that water that was holding up the ground. And that meant the ground began to fall, and there was subsidence. Another aggravation of that was we were right adjacent to Hastings oil field, and oil is another liquid that is below the soil and holds up the soil. And if you pump the oil out, likewise the ground falls to displace that. And they were pumping like crazy from Hastings oil field and had been for 30 years. So that was aggravating the situation too. But the result of that was that actually the land in that whole area was falling. And over a period of about 20 years, it dropped 10 feet. So where we might have been 30 feet above sea level, now we were 20 feet above sea level. And that was 20 feet over 10 years. That's like 6 inches a year. That's half an inch a month. You could almost sit on your front porch and watch the ground falling in the front yard. Not quite that, but it was pretty extreme. So there was extreme subsidence. So the more the ground fell, the more vulnerable we were to rising tides, to floods, to backup from the ocean or Clear Lake or the creek system backing up onto that land that's now lower than it was before relative to the tides and the sea. So the combination of that, impervious cover, which caused huge problems, and the storm sewers, which were probably not the best way to take away the water, and then the subsidence meant that it was an environmental disaster. And in 1979, that's only 15 years after NASA moved in. It only took 15 years to do this. But the impact over 15 years was that in 1979, there was a very big rainstorm. It wasn't even a hurricane. It was just a big rainstorm in July. And it dumped 32 inches in 24 hours. That is an enormous rainstorm. And everything flooded. So my family's house that had never, ever flooded, that land had never, ever flooded. It was about the highest land in the whole area, but we had 30 inches of water in our living room. And anybody who's been through a flood, it's horrible. It's just horrible. It ruins everything you have. Our house was a one-story house, 30 inches of water through the whole thing. That meant all of the books that were in bookcases down below, throw them away. They're all the photo albums, all your shoes, all your anything that was below 30 inches. All the furniture, because the furniture is made of wood, the wood swells, glue and stuff like that deteriorates. It's, you know, it pretty much ruins every piece of furniture. Stuffed furniture, it smells like shit, awful, ugh, after a flood. And all your carpet's ruined. It gets in the stud space. It gets all your insulation wet. You have to rip off all the sheetrock so you don't get it all mildewed in there. You basically have to take the whole house back to the studs if you're going to save your house at all. All the wiring is screwed up. So I was at that point living in Austin. When the flood happened, went down, helped my parents for a week, trying to just save the house, what we could save of it, and get rid of all the crap that was ruined in that flood. So that happened in July, and everybody said, "Oh, that was a 500-year flood." Woo! Yeah. Mother Nature, whoa, Mother Nature did that to us, 500-year flood. Well, we got that over now at least, and we got another 500 years and we can breathe easy, right? So then in 6 weeks later, a hurricane came through and it flooded everything again. People weren't back in their houses, most of them, but it just was another devastating, devastating flood. And people had to face up to the fact that, you know what? We screwed this place up. It was fine. It was fine for hundreds and hundreds of years. And now we've made it so even places that were high ground and were never flooded, now they're flooded because of impervious cover and subsidence and these problems that we've created. So that was in 1979. All the real estate values just plummeted in that whole area. You couldn't give away a house. So if your family had invested all their savings and their future in a house, now you had a devastated piece of junk and you couldn't get anything for it. And most people did not have flood insurance because this wasn't a flood-prone area. It had been fine for a long time. It was terrible, terrible for so many people. The whole community was depressed. So we could say this is an act of God. This is a natural disaster. But you know something? There was nothing natural about that disaster. That was a man-made disaster. It was greed. It was lack of environmental planning. It was dumbass stupidity. It was a lot of things that contributed to a really horrible event for that community. Now, that was in 1979. People rebuilt their houses. The Army Corps of Engineers came in and tried to do some improvements on the drainage system in the area. Things began to get back on their feet. And then in 1983, 4 years later, Hurricane Alicia came through and mostly the same thing happened again. At that point, people began to build their, when they rebuilt their house, they built it up on a 6-foot berm. They built the dirt up 6 feet and then built their house on top of that. or some people built their house on stilts so that they could have some recourse against that. The entire subdivision of imperial estates on one side of the creek, the bad side of the creek, they tore down all those houses and they didn't build anything back. And this was by then people began to get federal flood insurance. And finally, the federal flood insurance people said, we're not going to insure your house again, but we'll buy your lot from you. And so people just had to sell their lot back in because you couldn't build there. So all that, which was a very fancy subdivision, it's all gone now. And it only lasted maybe 20 years. Then it was all gone because that land was screwed up and you couldn't build on it anymore. So that's a sad tale. And that's an example of if we don't worry about geography, topography, ecology, if we don't do environmental planning, it can bite us in the ass big time, and it can create enormous human devastation. I'm actually really disturbed by the fact that when human disasters happen, even like Hurricane Katrina to some extent, and what it did to New Orleans, that was in many ways an environmental planning disaster too. That was a very bad hurricane, but it was because of things we'd done as human beings that really made that as devastating as it was. In that area, when I was a little bitty kid in 1961, Hurricane Carla came through that area. Hurricane Carla was the worst hurricane that had been through there since the great hurricane of 1900 that devastated Galveston. Hurricane Carla was a terrible, terrible, devastating hurricane. But there was virtually no property damage done in Friendswood. We stayed there through the whole storm. It didn't come anywhere near flooding our house. It didn't flood anybody's house. There were some trees that fell down and some destruction by that, but there was really no flooding to speak of. That was in 1961. In 1979, not that long after, there was devastating flooding by a hurricane that wasn't even as big as Hurricane Carla had been. So you can't say these are natural disasters. We've got to look to ourselves and say, what are we doing? And can we do this better? So the answer is, of course we can do this better. And our second example today is a good example. And this one is of the woodlands. And I have to make it really clear, I'm only talking about the first phase of the woodlands. They also screwed up things in the second, third, fourth, fifth phase of the woodlands. But in the first phase of the woodlands, they figured out how to solve these problems. So I want to know how many of you are from the woodlands. Okay, so you also tell me if I'm screwing things up here. But basically, in the first phase of the woodlands, it was developed by a family, the Mitchells. So the Mitchells, George and Cynthia Mitchell, had made a ton of money in the oil business. And they took that ton of money and they bought a huge piece of land north of Houston. And they said, we're going to build a new town, not just a subdivision, a new town. And they brought in one of the top environmental planners in the country, a guy named Ian McCarg, who was from Philadelphia. He wrote a book called Design with Nature. I mean, he was all about how do you design with nature. And there was very much the same condition in this piece of land as there was in the area around Friendswood. It was relatively flat. The soil was a little different. It wasn't quite as sticky gumbo. A little bit more sandy soil around here. It was heavily treed, and in this case, primarily pine trees in the area. But dead flat, that same characteristic, and also subject to these huge rains, these enormous downpours that would happen. So Ian McCarg did several things that made this actually work as a new development. The first thing he did was he said, I'm going to take all of the lowest land, and we're not going to develop that at all. I mean, it looks basically flat when you're there, but of course, some areas are a little lower and some areas are a little higher. So all the areas that were lower this area around the blue here, that was the lowlands. And he said, we're not building anything there. We're going to make those recreation areas, and we're not going to build anything. And then the higher land, even if it's just a little bit higher, that's where all the homes and the shopping centers and the schools and things like that will be. So that was smart. The low land, the most vulnerable stuff, just stay away from it. Don't do anything there. Make it a preserve. Then the second thing he said was, then we're going to dredge out those low lands and make them a little bit lower, and we're going to make detention ponds. And a detention pond is a place where when there's a big, big rain, it can go to that low land and the water can just stay there, not screwing anybody up, not throwing it downstream where it might cause more damage down there, but just hold it there for a while and then slowly let it move downstream. So you make a big, essentially a big tank that you can fill with water in the extreme case of a heavy rain. So the second step was to make these detention ponds. Then the third thing they decided to do was to go back to a drainage system that was kind of like those ditches that I talked about that we had when I was a little kid. Now, they didn't want to call them ditches because, whew, that sounds awful. So they called them ground swales. So they had ground swales, and they didn't put them in the front yard. They put them in the backyard so that there was a series of grossly oversized ditches, essentially, that could carry the water to these detention ponds and evacuate it from the houses very quickly and completely. And then the fourth thing that they did was that they avoided impervious cover. So that if you could possibly make less concrete or less impervious cover, they did it. And I'll show you a number of ways they accomplished that. So remember this idea of you don't build on the lowest land, and instead they made it into hike and bike trails, park space. You could put a swimming pool there. Who cares if your swimming pool gets flooded? No big deal. You could put soccer fields. You could put baseball diamonds. You know, you can put all the kinds of things that, you know, you don't worry so much if they get flooded. You could put art exhibits out there. And so all of the lower land not only was then not vulnerable to, you know, destruction, but also became an amenity for the community. It was a soft green area. People could have recreation there. They could see art. They could enjoy it. So it was a real amenity as well. This is a great example on the right of that detention pond. So you can see that waterfall coming down there. See the little ducks here? Quack, 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 quack. And see, here's a little guy. He's fantasizing that he has a hick childhood like I had, but not really. But he's fishing, got his fishing pole there. But you can see this is a normal day in that pond. You see the normal water level in that pond? But then when a big rain comes, look how much more capacity that pond has. So it fills up and fills up and fills up. And instead of being in your living room, it's in the detention pond. And you're protected in your living room. So, brilliant idea. Not that difficult. Pretty simple idea. Just taking care and managing the water. Here's an example. This is, you know, big, fat-ass, fancy house there. And they don't have the ditch in the front. They've got a ground swale in the back. And so it looks, you know, looks beautiful. But also you can see that there's no curb on the streets or anything. So all the drainage is in the back. They don't have a storm sewer system like that one I was talking about that had a finite capacity. And then on the left, this is an example of improving impervious cover. See the where they've got a hardscape. This is in a commercial area, and you're walking around from one shop to another. It could be concrete, and that would be impervious cover. But instead, it's a wood deck, and the wood deck has little gaps between it, and the water goes through, and it still gets absorbed in the ground. So you can walk on it, and you don't have to worry about mud or anything like that, but at the same time, it's able to absorb water. So everywhere where you can, you avoid impervious cover. And they even did that in the streets. Instead of the streets being 32 feet wide, which most municipalities require you to have 32 feet wide of concrete. Your car is about 8 feet wide. Two cars going past each other, that might take 20 feet. And you've got a 32-foot wide street. That's so if you happen to have your Christmas party at the same night as you have your Christmas party, you've got plenty of parking spaces on both sides of the street. Yeah, how often does that happen? Never. So you look at these 32-foot wide streets, and there are tons of impervious cover, and most of the time they're just blank. Stupid. It's stupid. So instead in the Woodlands, in the first phase, they made 22-foot wide streets. 22-foot wide streets. They saved a third of the impervious cover. And it still functioned. You know, they'd have a little parking area maybe for the occasional visitor. But they didn't have it along every street on both sides of the street. So less impervious cover, ground swales in the back, detention ponds. All of this meant that in that first phase of the Woodlands, they did not have flooding. Even though the ecology was very much the same, for years and years and years, they did not have flooding. Now, lately, because when they built phase two, phase three, phase four, they did not always follow these principles. And that has meant that even some of the original area occasionally gets flooded now. But originally, for a good 20 years, it just worked like a clock. It was great. Now, I have to say that the Woodlands in the first phase, it was butt ugly architecture. So it was environmentally fantastic, but it was not beautiful. And that might have been better another way. But I still admire it enormously for its environmental characteristics. Okay, so that was one good example. Here's another really good example where it's not just environmental, but it's architecture too. This is northern coast of California. We talked about it a couple of times ago, or last time. Yeah, last time. We talked about the condominiums at Sea Ranch. This is the 5,000-acre development that those condominiums were a part of. It was bought by a large corporation, and they were going to make these homes in this beautiful, beautiful setting. Oh, my God, gorgeous landscape, beautiful views of the Pacific Ocean, extremely windy, as I talked about last time. This whole area had been covered with redwood forest until the end of the 19th century. At that point, they came through and clear-cut the redwoods all the way through there and used them for timber. And that's essentially what built San Francisco. But then they allowed all of the redwoods to grow back. If you went back about a mile from the coast, they allowed the redwoods to come back. But the area immediately next to the coast, they kept as grazing land for cattle. So over the last 120 years or so, that's been grazing land, or was grazing land for cattle. And when they made it grazing land, I told you, it's so freaking windy, it knocks you on your ass if you're not careful. So the poor cows were out there, and they're grazing along, and the wind blows them, and poof, they're knocked on their ass. So they built these windbreaks, and they're essentially their hedgerows, and you can see them going in this direction, and there's another hedgerow going in that direction, another one in that direction. So they were perpendicular to the coastline, and that's what they looked like inside. They'd be two rows of Monterey cedars, and they would make this sheltered place in between them. And so every so often, there were these hedgerows that went through there. And that's what the landscape looked like when they bought it. So it was pasture land with these hedgerows perpendicular to the coastline. And then about a mile in, it became redwood forests that were maybe 100 years old at that point. And this is the plan that was developed by Lawrence Halperin, another really good environmental planner. And the plan did several things. For one thing, it built the buildings up against the hedgerows to use that same wind protection. So you see those perpendicular lines, perpendicular to the coast. All of those are matching a place where there's a hedgerow. And it's building the buildings up against the hedgerow to get the same protection the cows got. And the other principle they used was that instead of having, you know, like most subdivisions, lots and lots of roads, lots and lots of cul-de-sacs, lots and lots of individual houses on individual lots, instead they clustered the houses together. And then they left big pieces of land completely unobstructed. so that you kept the natural environment, the natural ecology, for maybe 60 or 70% of the land. And then you concentrated when you built something in a smaller area. And then everybody who lived in those clusters could then look out to a big meadow, and from that to the big ocean beyond. And you got much better views than if you just had one string of houses right up against the coast. They all got the big view, and then everybody else only got to look at their backside, which is the way most developers would have done it. So you get the benefit of using the hedgerows for protecting against the wind. You leave much more open space available. And this, we looked at the condominium building last time, built up against the hedgerow, as you can see there, nestled into it, and then clustered. There are 24 units in there. Instead of having 24 houses strung all over the place, they're all in one spot. And then you can have big meadows that don't have anything on them for the areas around. So other people, other architects built in this area too in a very similar way. These are some houses by Joseph Eschrich, and they're built up against the hedgerow. That's just like it was planned. And you see, they almost disappear. They're just nestled in that hedgerow. And they're using the shape of their roof is exactly deflecting the wind so that you can get a sheltered area over here to occupy. And you can see how the cedars are being bent by the wind. And he just takes those same lines of the wind moving and makes the roof line and makes the protection. And he's working with geography, topography, ecology, landscape issues. This is very sandy soil. If you start intervening in this too much, then the wind blows all the sand away and you have no more topsoil. So it's very important to have those prairie grasses whose roots hold that topsoil in place. So for as much of it as possible, they just left that topsoil and those native grasses. And then they just intervened in these particular areas. And the colors and the textures, everything of the buildings for the whole area are just beautifully controlled. And the houses almost disappear in the landscape. And the ecology of the place has been beautifully maintained. Sometimes this is a house that's actually underground. The grasses go up on the roof, and then it's tucked under there with a view of the ocean. This one is set down. As the ground falls off, it tucks in there so that you have very few obstructions to the view. We talked about the condominiums and their courtyard. Even things like recreation areas, the swimming pools, they use big earth berms that then protect the wind while you're half naked and wet and be freezing. Instead, now you're protected by the berms. And also then from the outside, you don't see the intrusiveness of the blue water of the swimming pool. Now, either we can build with good sensitivity to environmental planning, or we, if we don't do that, oh my God, it causes enormous pain and suffering and economic degradation and all kinds of other things. Okay, Twitter card question for the day. Going to be a little bit of a hard one, but I want you to think of some example. That is, the prime thing here is to think of a bad example. Can you think of some place you know where the building, the planning has been bad environmentally to the point that it caused a real problem? So that's the first choice, is find me a bad example. If you can't think of a bad example, then can you think of a good example? A place where the buildings worked with the geography, topography, ecology to produce a healthy total environment.